science is interesting, and if you don't agree, you can fuck off.
Kia ora, Alan. How are you doing today?
I'm doing very well, thank you, Shamina.
Hello. Fantastic.
Hey,
so this of course, is AUT's Alan Blackman, who chats with us every week for the fantastic segment Dear Science. First up today, we are looking at a new polymer worm that's been designed to move when it reacts to light. Can you tell me a bit about this?
Indeed. No, this is very, very cool. And if anybody's at all interested, if you Google polymer worm, there's a lovely little video that sort of accompanies this and shows you exactly what's going on. Anyway, the chemistry behind this is that some molecules, when you shine light on them, they change their shape. Okay, and they can go from sort of a linear shape to a bent shape. And obviously, when they do that, they take up different amounts of space. So you can imagine one molecule doing this, and you know, molecules are tiny, tiny, tiny things. But when you've got trillions and trillions, literally, of molecules doing this all at the same time, then it results in something that we can actually see. So there's some workers in the Netherlands and the States who have designed this molecule that does this, that changes its shape when you shine ultraviolet light on it. And that's a very, very common thing in chemistry. It's not unusual at all. But what these guys have done is to basically take a plastic strip, and they've lined one side of the plastic strip with these molecules lying down and the other side of the plastic strip with these molecules standing up on their end.
Mm.
Okay. And what then happens is that they shine light on it, the molecules all change their shape, and then when motion occurs, some of the molecules go into the dark, and when they go into the dark, they change back to what they were originally. And so you've got this process, this sort of on-off process. And it's different on both sides of the strip. So as you'd see on the video, and again, it's hard to describe, but you've got this little sort of couple of centimetre long piece of plastic strip and sort of wiggling like a worm. And it can move as fast as a caterpillar. And it's just absolutely brilliant. Really, really, it's just a great application of science, I guess. It may have uses. They're talking, everything's got to have a use these days. You can't just do science for science's sake, sadly. And so they've talked about perhaps sort of self-cleaning devices where you can get these things, perhaps you shine light on them and they move across mirrors or solar cells or things like that. They're talking about sort of solar cells out in the desert and they get covered in sand and stuff, and you can get these things perhaps that's going to absorb the ultraviolet light and sort of walk across them and clean them all in one go. But that may or may not happen. But in terms of applied science, it's an absolutely brilliant little thing. It really, really is spectacular. And, you know, people, you can sort of see the thought processes that people have put into this to figure out how to get this to work. Very, very simple concept once you, in hindsight, as everything is, obviously, all these great advances and stuff. But, obviously, people have put some really good thought into this and they've developed a really, really nice piece of science. And as I say, who knows, you know, it may have applications in the future.
Mm. When I was watching the video that you sent me, I sort of thought it looked like it was, I don't know, maybe 30 centimetres long, and then I saw another photo further down in the article of, you know, somebody holding it, and it was so tiny. So that made me think, could they do it at scale?
I don't see any reason why they can't. All that you've got to do is get all of the molecules doing it at the same time. So as long as you can blat them with light, they're all going to be doing this process. And so really there shouldn't be sort of any limitations with that. So I guess watch this space. I think they will certainly be looking to develop this bigger and better, I guess.
Yeah. It's really cool.
It is. No, it's fascinating stuff. Good solid chemistry, that. So, yeah.
So next topic we're looking at is how the current Qatar diplomatic crisis is impacting the world's supply of helium.
Yes, and your listeners might think, so what? So we need to sort of delve into a little bit of sort of science here. So helium is an extraordinarily important element for reasons I'll go into, but also it's an element, it's the second lightest of all the elements on planet Earth, and therein lies its problem, because it's so light that it's unaffected by gravity, and so it just goes straight up through the atmosphere into outer space.
I have memories of going to the Easter show with my mother, and I got this dolphin helium balloon that the knot wasn't tied enough around my wrist, and I just remember seeing it floating off into the distance and just crying.
Yep, the pain.
And we had to go back and get another one. Anyway, continue.
Oh, the banter. We could be the edge.
Yeah, I know. Look at this.
Top-notch banter. That's what we love on Dear Science.
Now, where were we? Right, helium.
Yes, yes.
So it is less dense than air, and so therefore it pops up and we lose it. So our supplies of helium on the planet are limited. And helium is basically formed from radioactive decay deep inside the bowels of the Earth, so in rocks and stuff. So you've got these radioactive minerals and rocks. They decay, they give off helium, and depending on whether or not the crust or the surface of the Earth is porous at that particular point, it'll either worm its way up and out and get lost to the atmosphere. Mm. Or if it's in a particular geological area that traps gas, then it'll stay trapped until somebody digs down and gets it, which is why...
Sorry, so they mine it. They mine it
like
natural gas.
Yes, exactly. Oh, you're ahead of me.
Yeah. Sorry. Oh.
So that is why helium co-occurs with natural gas.
Mm.
Because these gas pockets contain not just natural gas, but any sort of gas that's down there. And so helium's getting continuously formed. And so Qatar, obviously natural gas producer, and they produce around about 30% of the world's helium. And as listeners no doubt know, Saudi Arabia and co. are a little bit pissed off with the Qataris at the moment. And so they have blocked their land border, and there's only one. They're a little sort of almost an appendix, I guess, that are sticking out into the Arabian Gulf. Or Arabian Sea, whichever. Yeah. And so that has stopped them being able to export the helium. Now, why should we be worried about helium? Well, if you have ever had an MRI, magnetic resonance imaging scan, then helium is very, very important there, because in order to do those MRIs, you need a very, very, very strong magnetic field. And one of the best ways of getting very, very strong magnetic fields is by cooling them down to temperatures that are about as cold as you can get. So, in other words, about negative 269 degrees Celsius. And considering you can only get to negative 273 degrees Celsius, that's pretty cold. And the only way you can get that is using liquid helium to cool it down to that temperature, because that's the temperature that helium boils at. So, helium is kind of important in medical instrumentation and certainly scientific instrumentation, anything that involves high magnetic fields. So, you can see the problem.
Mm.
So, there's a whole bunch of MRIs all around the world and hospitals everywhere. They are relying on a continuous supply of liquid helium. Certainly in scientific institutions like AUT and Auckland, we have things called NMRs, nuclear magnetic resonance spectrometers, which are MRIs applied to molecules, basically. Very expensive pieces of kit. They've got to run at liquid helium temperature as well, so we've got to get those filled up every 6 months or so. It costs an arm and a leg, so those costs are going to go even higher now thanks to this blockade.
Such a significantly less supply.
So, yeah, it's not good. So goodness knows when this is all going to get sorted out or whatever, but until it does, doubtless the prices of these things are going to go up and up and up. And it's really not good to lose 30% of a world supply of anything.
What about an alternative? So if helium, theoretically, if it all disappears, what would be replaced with it? What would they use?
You are feeding me my material. Yeah. It's just, this is so good. Yeah. Well, funny you should say that, Adam. liquid helium boils at minus 269 degrees. Liquid nitrogen boils at minus 196. Nitrogen is obviously way cheaper than helium, because 78% of the stuff that we breathe is nitrogen. And so if we could get these very strong magnetic fields to work at liquid nitrogen temperatures, then problem solved. Okay. And there's obviously a lot of work going into that, because about 20 odd years ago, they discovered these things called high temperature superconductors, which allowed the generations of these magnetic fields, or the sustenance of these magnetic fields, at liquid nitrogen temperatures. And so you can imagine there's a buttload of work going in on that. And New Zealanders are at the forefront of that. There's a team down in Wellington who are real world leaders in this particular area of high temperature superconductors, which is, you know, really, really nice. So ultimately what will happen is that liquid nitrogen will replace helium. It's just a matter of getting the requisite technology and being able to apply that, and, you know, rest assured that will happen. But for the moment we're stuck with helium, and we need it. So come on, Arabs, sort everything out, guys. Yeah, come on, yeah.
But although, yeah, I don't know, it's like it's very stressful because one of the things on the table was the closing of Al Jazeera. So it's kind of like,
oh yeah, no,
we're not choose.
We're not having
helium
that.
Or Al Jazeera. Like, is this what's happening right now? They both suck. Both of these options suck.
Yeah, yeah, no, you're absolutely right. Yeah, Al Jazeera is very good, but yeah, yeah, agreed.
Yeah, fingers crossed it gets sorted sooner rather than later.
Indeed.
So last on the show today, we are talking about how chemists have recently unraveled the reason why humans aren't constantly burning into flames. Can you tell me about this? Why are we not doing that?
Yeah, no, that's a really good question. And it's a question that people probably should have asked before now. Why don't we spontaneously combust? Because according to the laws of chemistry, we should.
Really?
Oh, yes, indeed. Really? Okay. Oxygen. Okay, that's it's an absolute necessity for life, obviously. We need oxygen. But also, pretty much everything on planet Earth reacts with oxygen to some extent or other. Okay, and in chemistry, we have a branch of science called thermodynamics, and that tells you whether something can happen or not. Okay, whether a particular chemical reaction can happen or not. And yes, if you take any carbon-based anything, basically, with oxygen, then it will react with oxygen and it'll form carbon dioxide and water, okay? And that's called combustion. So you're familiar with that. You take wood, you light it, it burns. That's the reaction with oxygen. Similarly, we're carbon-based, so all of our carbon-based molecules, given the chance, would react with oxygen, we'd burst into flame, and that would be it. We'd turn into carbon dioxide. So it's a really, really good question, but a very, very... You know, a fairly sort of obvious question, but nobody's really sort of asked it before. So along comes this guy by the name of Roald Hoffman, who's a Nobel laureate in chemistry, and he has a history of asking these sort of seemingly obvious questions that nobody's sort of ever thought of the answer to. And I'm going to make a detour into the world of advertising, because
go for it.
We've all heard of free radicals, haven't we? We've all seen the advertisements for cosmetics and stuff like that, saying, "Oh, these nasty free radicals, and oh, they're going to age your skin and everything, and you're going to end up looking 90 when you know all that sort of stuff." And you need these antioxidants to neutralize these free radicals. You've all heard that.
Yeah. Mm. Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
It's crap. Yeah. Okay. Okay. It just is. Okay. Because oxygen itself is a free radical. Okay, and not a lot of people know that. So, definition of a free radical, anything that's got unpaired electrons, okay?
Right.
Free radicals like superoxide, now that's a bad free radical. That does sort of do nasties inside you. It can be carcinogenic, et cetera, et cetera. Oxygen is a pretty good free radical, okay? Two unpaired electrons, so it should be really, really bad for you, according to all the advertisers, but it's not. It sustains life. So the question this guy asked, he said, right, why does this free radical, which should be really, really reactive, why doesn't it react with all of the molecules in our body and we just turn into a puff of smoke? And he came up with the answer, which is quite involved, but basically it just sort of, it's all to do with the way that the electrons are arranged within the oxygen molecule. And so he'd done some, he basically sticks it in a computer and it sort of spits out an answer, and he compares this with experimental results, etc., 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 and the long and the short of it is basically that it's all to do with the way that the electrons are arranged. But it's a really, really interesting question. There are supposedly documented cases of spontaneous human combustion. If you sort of look around,
there's some good Discovery Channel documentaries. Like
there are good Discovery documentary channels.
Well, good quotation mark. Yeah.
And you know, as I say, technically anything carbon-based should react with all the oxygen in the air, and we shouldn't be, basically. But thanks to another branch of chemistry called kinetics, that makes us stable with all of this oxygen around us, so we're all okay. And same with the air as well. I always tell my first year students this: you've got nitrogen and oxygen in the air, and theoretically they should react together and form NO2, which is that yellow gas that's in sort of all those photos of LA, you know, smog and stuff. That's the yellow color of smog. So why doesn't it? Why doesn't the nitrogen and the oxygen in the air get together? come and do first year chemistry at AUT and I'll tell you the answer. There we go.
Nice little plug worked in there. Fair enough, fair enough. But aren't they, don't they, I don't know, from what I remember in chemistry in high school, which isn't a lot, just to preface this, but isn't oxygen like O2?
It is.
Sort of,
yes.
That stabilizes it in a way.
Yes, it does.
So that's why it's not reacting with the nitrogen?
But that's, you know, they in those days they didn't tell you the whole truth because you couldn't handle the truth. sadly, that's the case, that when we teach chemistry, we start off with these very, very sort of simple ideas, and we don't tell the whole truth. So, the stuff
we
that you would
drip fed,
yeah, basically, yeah, yeah,
alternative truths.
Oh God, but it shouldn't be that way. We should teach the truth from the start, because everyone can work it out. It's not that bad. But what you would have got taught is that all of those electrons all pair up and everything, and they're all everything's happy.
Yeah.
Which is not the way that it is. So, yes.
Dun
yes.
dun dun. Okay, so continue. So we've clarified that.
Yep.
So the oxygen and the nitrogen aren't reacting in the air. And then, why aren't they?
Well, I told you. You come to my lectures.
I
can't go away on my secrets.
Give us the Spark Notes version.
Okay. Here we go. Sheesh, first year chemistry in 2 minutes. In order for any reaction to happen, it's got to get over an energy barrier. Okay? So technically, if you take nitrogen and oxygen and react them together, the product that you get is going to have a lot lower energy than nitrogen and oxygen itself. Okay? Happy with that?
Mm-hmm.
That's the driving force. Okay? So it says that if I react, if this nitrogen, this oxygen reacts, it's going to get to a lower energy state. Everything wants to go to a lower energy state. Okay? So that's thermodynamics.
Mm-hmm.
But in order to get to that state going downhill, it's got to go uphill first. Okay? And the amount that it's got to go uphill first determines whether or not it's going to happen at an observable rate.
Right.
And it just so happens that when nitrogen and oxygen get together, there's a big uphill part first before the big downhill part comes. And so thankfully, they don't react, I'm not saying at all, but they react to a very, 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 very tiny degree.
So there's too much of an energy barrier
for it
spontaneously combust.
Absolutely, that's exactly right. So that's why we don't spontaneously combust, is because of this energy barrier, and this energy barrier comes in part because of the way that the electrons are arranged in the oxygen molecule. It really is fascinating stuff. This guy, Roald Hoffman, he's sort of a polymath. He's written poetry, he's written plays, he's not your average Joe Blogg scientist. He was born in what was Poland, now the Ukraine, in the war. He had to live in an attic for, it was like Anne Frank sort of material. He was just an absolutely brilliant, brilliant guy. Went to the States, didn't speak English, ends up winning the Nobel Prize about 30-odd years later. You know, he's just a wonderful human being. So, yeah, fascinating man. Yeah, really, really brilliant. Yeah.
Awesome.
Yeah.
That's so cool. Probably would have blown the mind of 14-year-old Shemina, so maybe it was best that that's not part of the Year 10 chemistry curriculum. But hey, we can agree to disagree on that one.
Fair enough.
Thank you for joining us
once
again, Alan.
Not a problem.
We'll talk to you again next week.
Will do. Cheers.
That was Dear Science.